So I am Eric Lofgren, and the title of this talk is Mathematical Modeling of Outbreaks Explained, Real Life Lessons from the Living Dead. And this was done in collaboration with one of my mentors and the woman who taught me mathematical modeling, Nina Pfefferman, who's currently at the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Natural Resources, and the Center for Discrete Mathematics and Theoretical Computer Science, both of which are kind of a mouthful, at Rutgers University. The authors have no conflicts of interest to disclose. If anyone has an idea of how I could get conflicts of interest in this, I'd be more than willing to listen. So the overview of this, essentially what we're going to go through, is mathematical modeling and its role in public health. Why is this something we care about? Why is this something we should be teaching? And why, in terms of a transdisciplinary sense, why we should be incorporating both public health students talking to mathematicians, and then vice versa, mathematicians talking to public health students. Some of the problems with how, at least I perceive, mathematical modeling and epidemiology in this country currently being taught, and then how can we fix those problems? A spoiler, the solution to those are zombies. So mathematical modeling in public health is actually a very established field. Bernoulli, in 1760, wrote a model explaining the transmission of smallpox. You'll note this actually predates John Snow, so technically mathematical modeling is older than observational epidemiology. Its more modern incarnation comes out in the early 1900s. You get a lot of kind of the really famous names in epidemiology. Ross, Reed, Frost all worked on mathematical models, especially of infectious diseases, working on how do you control these containment strategies for a lot of the early diseases, smallpox, malaria, things like that. It's an invaluable tool in modern public health. One of its primary strengths, I think, is it can illustrate very difficult to grasp concepts and places where people's intuition about what's going to happen kind of break down. So you can look at things like herd immunity. You can, with actually a fairly simple model that undergraduate students can do, you can show herd immunity, that you don't have to vaccinate everyone to essentially kill off an infectious disease. And then you can look at things like competing or complementary interventions. You can write a model where you do four things at once. You say, okay, can we vaccinate people, also treat the people who are sick, add a quarantine aspect to it, and encourage people to kind of socially distance themselves from people who are sick all at the same time, and say, what effects do those different components have? Do they help or hinder each other? So things like that, where especially kind of the people's gut level intuition or your ability to model it in a more statistical sense break down. It also allows quantitative research on difficult, expensive, or otherwise infeasible questions. You can ask things about pandemics, where you can't actually infect several million people with a disease to find out what happens, or where it would simply be impractical to do that. So large-scale studies, questions about, well, could we change the way a school district sends kids home during influenza season, where you can't actually do that in a modern setting, but it would be really nice to have some grounding in numbers, some ability to compare on things like that. So very briefly, I'm going to go through the most basic model that gets used. It's also by far the most common. It's called the SIR model. It's a compartmental model that essentially what you have is you have your population partitioned into these three compartments, susceptible, infectious, and then depending on who you ask, either recovered or removed. Removed tends to mean dead. It's a polite way to say that. Recovered tends to be that you have recovered from the disease and now have a lifelong immunity to it. So what happens is you start with, generally speaking, an entirely susceptible population, with the exception of a very small number of infected people. Often this number is one. And then as time goes on, the susceptible individuals will essentially mix randomly with the infectious individuals. Some of them will become infected and move to the next category. And then further as time goes on, some of those infected people will either recover or die and move on to the recovered category. And you can see essentially the progression of the disease over time. How you transition between these compartments is usually governed by a set of parameters that are expressed as a series of differential equations. And this is where the first problem arises. I don't know about the rest of you, but when I was thinking about my career in academic public health, I should take differential equations was not one of the things that occurred to me. This is a very simple model. With anything more complicated, this very quickly becomes kind of a wall of equations. People's eyes glaze over. You stop really keeping track of what happens. The strength of these models is there's near infinite variety. Essentially, you can put as many compartments and as many lines as your heart desires, and the only limitation is how much time you're willing to spend on it. So in contrast to the math, the results you get from this are often very intuitive, very easy to understand from a public health perspective, and really reinforce concepts people know. So this is actually an implementation of the model you just saw with 1,000 people in the population. So the black line is how many people are in the susceptible compartment. So you see as the outbreak begins, the number of susceptible people in the population plummets as they all get sick, and then eventually bottoms out to zero. So essentially, this disease made its way through the entire population. Everybody got it. In contrast, the reverse happens with the recovered. Everyone got the disease. Eventually, everyone recovers, and now you have a completely immune population. And then you have kind of the classic epidemic curve is the red line. That's the number of people in the infectious category. That's a very familiar curve to anyone who's taken an epidemiology class. As the number of recovered people rises and the number of susceptibles drop, the disease dies out. And essentially, since this one has a permanent lifelong immunity, it goes away forever and is extinct. So these are concepts that are pretty easy to grasp, are fairly approachable to public health people. The problem is how you get these results is difficult, time-consuming, and generally speaking, outside of what we consider our core competencies. So the typical teaching approach for public health students is to ignore the math entirely. Yeah. The emphasis is on the interpretation of it. So someone has wrote a mathematical modeling paper in your field of interest. What does this mean? What do their results mean? How can you take this and apply it to your, you know, studies and observational settings? Or how would you build these models? So you think about how they're built, you think about the results, and the math itself is left as a black box. You might as well essentially write, then a miracle occurs, curves come out, and you can start talking about the results. For math students, the exact opposite is true. Mathematical models of infectious diseases are often taught as a subset of a field called dynamical systems, which is essentially you learn how to use differential equations and multivariate calculus, and then you say, okay, so what do you do with this? And you start rattling off, you know, rocket science and epidemiology and population biology, and you touch very briefly on it, but there's no real exploration of the field that this is modeling. So there's problems for both. Public health students then have only a very loose grasp of what it takes to implement one of these models and then analyze it. So part of the problem with that is then, as public health people are wont to do, we start making very complicated models that we feel kind of fully describe the system. And then somewhere a mathematician is crying because they have to implement this. And the public health people really have no intuition about, so I added this one compartment, how much more difficult did this become? If we start looking by, if we stratify our population by age and gender, that seems like a really approachable thing. Whereas from a mathematical perspective, now you need whole matrices of parameters and, you know, hours and hours of work. So that's the problem from the public health side. The problem from the math side is that the math behind this, you often focus on mathematically interesting points that are of only limited use to public health people. You can prove for the system I showed that it will eventually reach a point of stability, which is interesting from a mathematical perspective, that this doesn't cycle forever, eventually it levels out, but you can't necessarily find out where it will level out. And from a public health perspective, if it stabilizes at 1,000 people or 3 people, that's a very important distinction. And so the focus is generally on well-characterized models and putting them in new circumstances. Another problem that I don't mention on this is kind of the opposite of the public health problem. As these models become more complex, they become much more difficult to get provable things out of. And so the mathematical tendency is to avoid things that will then make it difficult or impossible to prove things about the system, whereas as far as the public health people are concerned, you should be aiming towards realism. So what happens is that the understanding and communications between these two fields are kind of lost. You have people coming about it from entirely different directions, and they kind of pass each other in the middle, look over, and watch the other person fly by. So comparing this to how we teach observational epidemiology, most observational epi methods, I refer to them as disease agnostic. You learn a general toolkit that you can then apply to any question you want. You can be an observational epidemiologist interested in infectious diseases or chronic disease, disability, and you will use the same methods. And you can, I believe, get through an entire epidemiology methods core sequence without ever actually mentioning a specific disease. You can, for example, the kind of canonical 2x2 table, you look at exposed and unexposed, disease and not diseased, and it doesn't matter what that disease is at all. Mathematical epi, on the other hand, you use disease-specific toolkits. I wrote a model about measles, which the problem with that requires very large amounts of subject matter expertise to effectively design the model. You have to know how this works. And then on the other end, you have to know how the equations work to implement it. So what happens from the mathematical side is that models are often borrowed, adapted, or modified, and often this is kind of flawed. So you'll take, for example, a very famous model, the Ross-McDonald model, which is used to look at malaria control. And you'll say, well, dengue fever is kind of like malaria. It's, you know, a mosquito-borne thing. So I'll use the Ross-McDonald model for dengue, which then totally ignores the risk of reinfection with dengue. And then you'll say, well, yellow fever, the same thing. It's carried by mosquitoes. I can use a Ross-McDonald model. And then you get really intuitive leaps like, well, if we say nurses are like mosquitoes, I can use the Ross-McDonald model to look at hospital-acquired MRSA. And this is actually, the Ross-McDonald model is the canonical compartmental model for hospital infection control. So you get these kind of, well, this is the one I understand, this is the one that there are proofs about, so I'll use this without really thinking about, is this the appropriate model to use? So in my view, what's required for a unified approach to this is from the public health side, we need solutions that allow students to fully implement models on their own to kind of gain the intuition about the math, which requires familiar software, approachable mathematics, and results that they can see that are grounded in practice. Because it does nobody any good to teach them how to prove if the system stabilizes if that's not what they care about. From the mathematical side, we need to give them problems that allow for the discussion of disease mechanics and modeling choices. The answer to this needs to not be go get an MPH. And at the same time, we need essentially things that allow discussions about model choice, not a list of templates you can use. So the solutions from the public health side are difference equations, which are somewhat more approachable. They essentially say, instead of differential equations, which say the continual change, this says at each time step, what happens? And this is essentially, I mean, you have division, some subtraction, and some multiplication. This is fairly approachable. Public health people can do this. You can understand what comes out of it. And the advantage is a fair amount of the time, the results are exactly the same. So you can start developing some of the intuitions that will come and then eventually be able to translate those back onto these differential equation systems and say, I think I know how this model will work. These are far more approachable. They can be implemented in software people know how to use. They can be implemented in Excel, Numbers, which is the Apple version of Excel, R, I think SAS. I have not actually done it in SAS, but I'm pretty sure you can. So things like that, software that they're familiar with, rather than saying, you need to go program this by hand, or go find out if your university has a copy of MATLAB, and then go learn that. And you get, essentially, you cannot prove anything about one of these systems, so you immediately go to those graphical results that are, for public health people, far more intuitive and generally favorable. For mathematics, the solution is zombies. And modeling the zombie epidemic. So modeling the zombie apocalypse has some things behind it. Zombie outbreaks are what I call a common cultural reference point, especially among the student-age population. Whether you are a public health major or a math major, you probably went to go see 28 Days Later. There is a large library of media about zombie outbreaks, which have slightly different interpretations of how zombies work. And one can, with a single night and a local blockbuster, become the equivalent of a subject matter expert. So there are advantages beyond that to using this. It's an accessible disease-based system with a large number of different interpretations. And as such, you can discuss the differences between those interpretations and how that may affect modeling choice. So one of the strengths of this is that as you move between models, generally you also move between diseases. So it's hard to tell whether the changes you saw were because you went from smallpox to measles to malaria, or because you changed the way the model worked. So here, you're using the same disease, so all of your parameters have stayed constant, but if you add a compartment, you can see, well, it slowed down the epidemic, it sped it up, it changed the magnitude of it. Those are then purely the result of your choices rather than constantly changing the disease you're looking at. And that's the idea of the mini models, one disease framework. For example, the most basic model is the survivor infected zombie model. You can add then a removed category, which is either infected or then zombies being killed by the survivors. You can attempt to model quarantine. So if you are bitten, we can essentially, you know, move you from the general population and stop you from mixing, which will then stop you from transmitting the disease. You can ask, what happens if we attempt to quarantine the survivors, if they lock themselves in a shopping mall or something like that? And then the yellow arrow is for anyone who's ever watched a zombie movie, you know that doesn't work perfectly. So there's some question about, well, if we change the parameter that governs just how well they manage to isolate themselves, what happens? And you can actually get, and these become then much harder to show graphically, some very complex concepts. Pulsed eradication campaigns, day-night cycles, seasonality, multiple infection routes, and sensitivity of your results to assumptions. For example, how you and the zombies mix. So wrapping this up, modeling zombie infection using difference equations and well-understood tools represents a unified, discipline-independent way of teaching epidemiological modeling, which would be ideal for an introductory course for advanced undergraduates or introductory graduate students. It allows the mathematicians to explore the diseases, the disease people to explore the math, and both of them to interact using a common point of reference. This is my contact information. It's a little dark on here. Eric.Lofgren@unc.edu. And thank you very much.
Thanks to all three of you for the really wonderful knowledge you shared today. So I think we will open it up to discussion and questions at this point in time. I think they're going to stay there, so you can just talk to them.
So I actually teach public health undergraduates, and I'm wondering if I contact the three of you, if I could get more specific information on how this might be used. I'd like to know more about the zombies, because they would really go for that.
Yeah,
they would suffer through mathematics
for zombies. You're more than welcome to email.
Thank you.
Also, I saw it around Halloween this year, there's a show called Community. I think it's supposed to be about a community college, and the whole Halloween episode, it was called Epidemiology, and it was about the zombie outbreak at their Halloween party. So if you want to use that as like an intro, you totally can.
Within the disability.
section, there's obviously a lot of interest around the issue of stigma and discrimination that does come about, come about through language, at least in part, through some implication of policy in other kinds of ways. It's not always very obvious, but social attitude is repeatedly one of the highest barriers that's listed by people who suffer from that disability. Within public health, it has been this issue of, so it's moving from preventing disability, which has always been sort of the getting out of that starting block, to now how do we maximize, and not only health, but we've been trying to push participation. So that, you, that the, I don't live my life only to be healthy. I live my life to live well, live fun, live fully, and how to be starting to think about what some of those core outcomes are. But you were asking a question that's much more, what are the steps in order to bring a greater societal awareness and inclusion up? And I do think that attention to language is one of them. Attention to how we measure our outcomes. The whole issue, when, once you start to, and you didn't go into economics, which but there are economic models of disability-adjusted life years and totally-adjusted life years, where the basic assumptions of that, and people are very sensitive to, you know, I'm only one notch away from being dead. And so it's those kinds of values and how to expose the process underneath some very common and well-accepted public health practices. I think that is all part of what it's going to be coming about. We are pitching it so much around, it is so much more prevalent than we think about, that disability really is another diversity, that it's very dynamic, that some of us will be disabled for shorter periods of time, and some of us longer, some of us more severely, some of us intermittently, but that it is very much a part of the human condition. So how do we sort of get over the dichotomy, and start, which is in part why a determinants model of health is much more exciting. It doesn't mean you have to break it out into disabled versus not, or healthy versus not, alive versus dead. I get that. Well, maybe now I've got a new category. Zombie versus dead. So I think it is a range of those things. And we operate with just, you know, the strongest, cleanest assumptions of doing good and social justice and not realizing that some of our underlying values are really part of what is creating the conundrum for other people.
With the last thing that you said, in terms of, you know, the good intentions and creating some, especially in talking about people with disability or chronic disease, because in public health as well as in medicine, you know, people go into that to try to, you know, initially usually to try to cure people, you know, the infectious disease models, and you know, you want to make people better a lot of times, and in public health you want to make the population, you know, as healthy as possible or as, you know, fill in the blank as possible. And because I think communities who have chronic disease or disability or once they do, you know, that's not that's in some way, you know, slightly less possible. It creates this, I've run into it, I'm a second year MPH student at Boston University, and I've run into it a lot in my intro, in certain concentrations. You know, we have to do a residence. But, and in certain, in epidemiology, they think chronic disease is interesting, they think, you know, it's kind of the mathematical stuff. They're like, ooh, that's a new thing to model, you know, and so they think it's cool. But when you talk about, especially to the social behavioral sciences people, it's like, whoa, we don't know how to do that a little bit. Or, you know, and then they go to the doctor, and then it's not part of public health. And my argument has always been, like, everyone goes to this, you know. Like, I think of health kind of as a continuum, and then, you know, government may have certain points to qualify for certain things, and maybe we think they should be different or the same or whatever, but it's, you know, it's a continuum.
start out their life a little bit further, you know, in a slightly different place, mm-hmm. or end up in a different place because of an illness or an accident or whatever, and it just depends when that happens, what your perspective is on that, I think. But it doesn't always come out in the public health education. It's not, or be included in terms of, you know, thinking about it when you're program planning, you know, how do you, if somebody comes to your clinic and is in a wheelchair or, you know, can't hear or whatever, or maybe they, yeah, so I appreciate what you're doing, and I was surprised, actually, that Boston University was part of, are you working with Deb Allen?
She's yeah. picked up. Ellen Myers was the person who was at Boston University. Told us that Ellen passed away.
Oh, okay. Then
yeah.
I should.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's right.
And I don't need to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really a gem.
Yeah. And I took a course with Deb Allen, Children with Special Health Care
Needs. That's right.
That kind of illuminated my thoughts on the matter mm-hmm. a lot, because I had worked with a disease-specific nonprofit that was. A lot of definitions, more chronic disease than disability necessarily, but taking her course kind of made me realize that they had a lot of commonalities.
In terms of being a teacher, just to get the discussion going with students about language and the underlying values that they represent and can really help move some of those values.
Just making people think about. To use the example of the quality adjusted life year, by saying that you are by implication saying your life is worth less now.
Yeah.
And so just thinking about that, I think, gets people moving on a track where they go, well, is that really what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And is that
mm-hmm.
really what I want to be saying? And things like that. And
I
think it's incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
Some of the groups that have worked the most to change language are actually those who work in palliative care. And even end of life, because you work at offering or catalyzing a sense of well-being in all times of life, regardless of how many years you have left.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that discussion is important.
Mm-hmm. In the course that I was in, Deb had us read one or two articles, one of which was very much about language and, you know, kind of setting the tone for, you know, we're talking about people with disabilities, we're not talking about, children with special health care needs, as opposed to the special health care needs kids, or, you know, I mean, very much, she set the tone about that, and she would remind us if we forgot, but we were pretty good about it, so. But it was one of those things that if she hadn't said it, we could have been going back and forth, and it really kind of set the stage where you're thinking about these children or people as people who happen to have X, Y, and Z.
And I think while we're talking about multi-transdisciplinary, and you said you view it sort of as a continuum, well, having a foot in, a big foot in public health and another foot in medicine, I would say that it would these exercises with your students where you're really challenging them to think about how we approach it, how we think about it, how we talk about it, say it, will lead, the other organizations will follow us. What I mean by that is like double AMC and, you know, the Nursing Association. We have to be the ones who model or, you know, expose that model first as in your course, and then I think we can make the transition. I'm currently sitting on an interprofessional collaborative panel. It's a national panel with all of our respective representative organizations for pharmacy, nursing, occupational medicine, public health, et cetera. And they're looking at how do we define what we're doing in our curricula. And one of the things that we listed as a domain is language. How are we saying what we're saying to folks? So anyway, sorry, my little two cents, but I think that we're the leaders in that, so.
And I think I come from, my minor in undergrad was women's studies, so, you know, we had entire chunks of like, all right, we're gonna talk about language and how we talk about things, and so I really brought it back to, you know, in some ways this is a kind of social justice, you know, social, more of the social
Absolutely.
Model than I had thought about it as before.
Is there any in the Disability Section Act? There were several really excellent panels, one really focused on measurement that really had me very intrigued. But at the end of the day, it was a panel on environment. That's been a new area for disability work to really start to think about, because disability is now not thought as being residing in the person. It's interfaced with your environment, whether it enables you or hinders you. And it's been a while coming to get some studies with some really good measurement to them. And there were some really, really powerful analyses of the American Community Survey, and disability epidemiology portrayed very graphically through GIS, which was totally cool and very techy. But one of the presentations was really a very, very basic knowledge on from the University of Illinois Chicago at Wayne on developing a really basic tool around knowledge. And it was it included things like, you know, knowledge about nutrition in eight different areas, I think. But it also was largely founded on Americans with Disabilities Act or other legal rights. And it's sort of like, and do you know? Because I know when I've had discussions with our MD and PH students, and they will challenge, they would say, why should every clinic bear the responsibility and the cost of needing to have a ramp or be accessible? And it just,
because why should we have to see every person in the United States as well? Why should we have to care for them?
Well,
why should we have to translate things into different languages?
But you know, when you're coming at it from an economic perspective, and it's the trade-off of transplants versus how many immunizations can you give, when you're still in that way of thinking, sometimes it's just really important to know there is a law guarantees these things. And so in this case, I was just like thrilled to see them developing what will be a really pretty basic little tool, but it's really about what you know, and then how empowering that can be for people when you really know what your rights are, or when healthcare providers know that, yep, you really do have to figure this out. And there are other people trying to help figure this out, but it is your responsibility. If you're going to get good healthcare, you have to know how to communicate with somebody, even if they are deaf.
And even broader than that, because we can't even work out communicating with folks if they speak another language. But even broader than that is that I'm the moderator, but I'm going to go
jump in.
Moderator is society's responsibility, especially in public health, as we look at built environments and working with folks with transportation, housing, architecture, et cetera, that we create a community that's not a second thought.
It is the
thought that goes into
power. And then it's a whole lot cheaper right from the get-go.
And we
really do learn a sense of valuing ourselves as well, because it allows us a little more flex. I can be injured, or I can be ill. And
absolutely.
The fundamental me is not negated in a societal kind of way.
One of the things I was really surprised about is just kind of a comment, but I was invited to sit in on a phone conference at Children's Hospital here, talking about Safe Routes to School, the program they were doing, and I had just taken Deb's course, so at one point I kind of said, you know, have you guys thought about, you know, Safe Routes to School for kids who have disabilities? You know, how's that fitting into it? And all of the people who were public health or medicine kind of went, oh my gosh, what? And the transportation lady was right on it. You know, she was used to buses and things like that, and I was really surprised. You know, coming from a public health perspective, I felt like the public health and medicine people should jump in there. But I was really surprised and also glad that she immediately was right behind me and you know, helped encourage that discussion.
So I just want to say something that this is a topic near dear to my heart, and I'll tell you why afterwards, Dr. Khan. But for you, I would like to, and it would come to you as well, I would just like to say that it's wonderful to see you introducing students to these two topics at this level, because the truth of the matter is, again, not being a moderator and giving an opinion, part of how we attack poverty around the world and how we ensure a higher level of health data is that those two things need to be linked, the financing and public health, and especially microfinancing, since data now seems to show that it's working in multiple areas of the world. So I think that when we start to join forces with the business folks, especially those that have our advocates for microfinancing, that we'll see large impact. So I'm so glad that maybe this generation will be the ones that figure it out. Maybe we can, you know.
I'm curious, you mentioned that two of your students changed their majors, but what kind of majors did students come to this?
They came with, there was one business major. The rest of them, there were several pre-med, and a couple of like sociology, English, basic liberal arts, humanities. And
I have an answer about whether the differential equations can be modeled.
Oh?
My friend says, I think yes, but it requires linear algebra to apply a model. You can only model it on the tangent line, I think, which you probably know more about what that means than I do.
it's
but
hard.
At least
it's,
I knew who to ask.
It's not an easy
yeah,
word.
There you go.
So that would be a hard step.
I mean, the answer is just use Excel.
I
use Excel for really complicated models that will wind up in papers, and just use Excel.
Okay. And I guess I'd like to say the same thing for what you presented here, that we just started an undergraduate in public health degree, as many places around the country have, and they have an introduction to epidemiology course, and to me this is this is where we want to be. Yeah, and we built on that. That's terrific. I mean, I was never taught, well, of course, we were never taught to really think about it in that way. So very impressive. I don't want to keep us too late. Any other comments or questions about 950? I know that at least one of our presenters has another presentation to attend.
Sure. I took intermediate EPI and we got into some of the mathematical.
But not in the anymore.
not using fun examples like zombies. But
do you ever use educational technology, we have a big distance learning program. My office, they do a lot of work in Second Life, which always makes me laugh because I'm like, I don't have enough time for my first life.
So
I'm
like,
thank
you.
Thank you, Dr. Grant. But do you ever, can you utilize this? I guess you can, because people are real people as avatars or whatever.
Yeah.
We can't go in and do a 20-minute later event.
We can't do something like this, but we actually, me and Dr. Pepperman wrote a paper. There was an outbreak in the World of Warcraft that they accidentally introduced an infectious disease, and we wrote up essentially an outbreak report on this, and then we have a project, and it's Second Life for elementary school kids. There's a in middle school kids. There's a program called Yville that's essentially a social networking and chat tool, and they have a disease called Ypox, and we're actually currently working on a project looking at people's perceptions of contagion when they're that young. How do they interact with it? Is this something they try to avoid or something they try to experience? And things like that. So we do use those.
Nice. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.